You're listening to Orange County's only station with critical business information, Critical Mass, with your host, Rick Franzi.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Mass Radio Show. I am your host, Rick Franzi. It's a pleasure to be here hosting the show today, and I host this business talk show, which airs live on Tuesday and Wednesday afternoons at 4 p.m. If you're listening to this show as a future podcast, I would encourage you to listen live during our broadcast times, heard exclusively here on octalkradio.net. The goal for this show is to help you, our listening audience, make better decisions. We do that by interviewing thought leaders and peer executives who have transferable knowledge, ideas, and experiences. I would like to thank Smart Business Magazine for sponsoring the show today. Smart Business Magazine is a management journal providing insight and advice for top decision makers. To learn more about Smart Business Magazine, visit their website, www.sbnonline.com, and select Orange County in the local journals area. Critical Mass, the radio show, is an extension of our 17-year consulting practice. We build CEO peer groups for executives and business owners in Orange County, California. We do this in partnership with Renaissance Executive Forums. Executive Forums is an international organization committed to helping their members take their business to the next level. My business partner, Doug Gefeller, and I currently host and chair multiple CEO peer groups. Doug is a master certified coach. This is a distinction achieved by less than 900 certified coaches in the entire world. Doug hosts a call-in talk show right here on octalkradio.net, heard every Thursday in this time slot, 4 p.m. My book, Critical Mass, The 10 Explosive Powers of CEO Peer Groups, was the first book ever written about the peer group experience and is available for sale on Amazon.com. Simply type in my name, Richard Franzi, when you're on Amazon, and up will come a copy of the book, and hopefully you'll decide to buy a few. If you'd like to learn more about the CEO peer group experience or executive coaching, then I would ask you to check out our website, www.criticalmassforbusiness.com. Criticalmassforbusiness.com. Finally, if you'd like to join in on the conversation today, the best way to do that is on the octalkradio.net website. Find the community chat room, log in, post your thoughts. Our producer, Paul Roberts, is watching those thoughts and expressions, and we'll possibly bring them to my attention, and I'll try to work them into the line of questioning that we have for our guests today, and we do have two. It's my pleasure to introduce our first guest, Gary L. Kramer of Kramer and Olson Accountancy Corporation. Gary, welcome to Critical Mass, the radio show.
Thank you.
It's good to have you on the show, and I'd like to start, Gary, by asking you a simple question, and that is, tell our audience a bit about your professional experience that kind of predates your founding of Kramer and Olson.
When I was in college, I always thought that the language of business was accounting, and because I wanted to be in business, I majored in accounting. Fortunately, I ended up being in the business of accounting, and my experiences include working not only in industry, but also working for one of the large national accounting firms after I had passed the CPA exam.
So did you in college, did you major in accounting, that you would ultimately be here today in your career, or would it happen?
I'm sorry, you had broken up.
Yeah, I said, did you know in college you were going to end up owning and running an accountancy firm?
No, I thought in college I was going to end up running some kind of business, and after having experiences of working with entrepreneurs and working on the ventures that they were involved in, it really intrigued me, and I pursued the opportunity to continue working with them by starting my own firm after I completed the state licensure requirements and experience that are required to become a CPA, and started off on my own and was able to grow to our four-partner firm that we have today.
You know, you said earlier that the language of business, and that really came home to me when I was in college and taking some courses in accounting and some courses in finance. I realized, because I'm sales and marketing for much of my career, but I realized how the language of business, a story can be told in the numbers. And at the end of the day, there are many other stakeholders around the business who want to hear the story told in numbers. You know what I'm saying? At the end of the day, if you're looking for outside capital or maybe investment or partners, strategic investors, etc., the story they want to have told them largely are within your financial statements many times, in addition to the vision that you have for the company, etc. All too often, sometimes entrepreneurs not neglect, but maybe don't spend as much time getting comfortable with that language of business and that story around their firm as they do maybe some of the other areas, whether it's technology or marketing, et cetera.
Well, the entrepreneurs are really busy developing their companies, and I think accounting is one of the last things that they deal with. They're too concerned about capital, managing bank accounts, keeping people working and doing whatever they have to do to keep the doors open. And because of our experiences of working with them, we're able to help alleviate some of the problems that they have and really act as transfer agents to take over responsibilities for them and help guide them during this building time. And also, by using an outside CPA firm and having their letterhead on your financial statements, whether it be a compilation or an audit or a review, that adds a certain amount of credibility that banks appreciate and look for, as well as outside investors. And that really helps the client working with outside financing.
Can you share with us a bit more about your firm and maybe how you have positioned it in the marketplace so that it is a differentiated consulting practice?
Our firm consists of four partners and probably altogether about 11 or 12 CPAs. Our marketplace or goal are closely held businesses in the probably $5 to $20 million marketplace, and these are businesses that are either have grown to that level or are really just getting started and have a lot of opportunity to reach there. We've placed ourselves in the marketplace and by working with the owners and being reachable. The owners want to deal with principals of businesses that they're engaged in. And if they go to a larger accounting firm, they do not get the same contact with a partner as they do with us. Our important stress to our staff and to all of our partners is we have to listen to what our client is looking for, and we have to be available to try and help guide them to their goal.
So in that market space, it's really kind of a business owner to a partner business owner is the relationship that you've been able to establish with your core clients.
That is correct.
Okay. And that, you know, that's part of the premise of Critical Mass, the radio show, Gary, and that we believe that there's a different kind of conversation that can happen between peer business owners or partners or managing partners. You know what I mean? It's just at sometimes there's a language that can be spoken between them that they understand each other at a level maybe that others who haven't shared in that responsibility or had that opportunity yet in their career sometimes don't appreciate or can't understand at that, you know, at that juncture in their life.
And I think also the owners of the businesses have more respect because they're dealing with owners of similar type businesses. And so by dealing with the top people, they feel a lot more comfortable and they feel a lot happier with the handholding that's provided.
I wonder if you could, I'm going to shift our and ask if of all the experiences that you've had in business and the lessons that you've learned throughout your business career, have you developed a guiding principle that you're using today to lead Kramer and Olson forward?
The guiding principle is what I said, and that is twofold. One is listening, and two, being the transfer agent so that we really alleviate our clients' fears and concerns by taking over their problem, helping them solve it, and then with a direction and solution, they can concentrate on what they need to do, and we get in there and do a lot of the hard work for them, and they can still continue working on their business problems other than the accounting issues. And also, I think the other part of our guiding principle is the pride that we have in ourselves and the maintaining of people that we have, that we provide our staff with challenges and great opportunities for growth, and they enjoy getting involved with our clients also.
Can you, how do I say this? I'm fascinated by the kind of work that CPA firms are doing for mid-market companies. Mid-market for me are, minimum of $5 million up, but no more than $100 million. And so your 5 to 20 is right solidly in the mid-market.
Well, there has been excuse me, we do go over 100. We actually do some clients over 100. But those are companies that have maintained us during their rapid growth.
So there you are. You got them when they were smaller, and you gave such great service that they just stayed with you as they continued to grow. Beautiful. But, there's been so much uncertainty, quote unquote, over the past couple of years, whether it's economic or it's kind of how is the government or governments, because, there's not just the federal government that a business owner has to worry about as it relates to, their taxes, et cetera, the state, county, local, whatever. There are other places that they have to be aware of, other institutions that they have to be aware of. But I'm wondering if you would be comfortable spending a few minutes talking in general terms with our audience of business owners and, CEOs, et cetera, about maybe some of the important tax law changes that you've seen happen and sort of what's the effect, or at least what should they as business owners be aware of in a general sense about tax law changes that are facing them this year?
There's been numerous changes that have come into effect in 2010 and 2011, but when you're dealing with closely held businesses, I think one of the most important changes really has to do with the estate law, the estate tax law, because they've increased the amount of the exemption to $10 million. So depending upon the liquidity and size of the estate, the client has the opportunity of gifting or passing on more money without estate tax. And between estate tax and income tax, those are probably the two largest concerns of successful owners of the business. One, how do they avoid or minimize the income tax? And two, how do they preserve the business? So I think the $10 million estate exemption or $5 million per person has been very, very good. In the last 25 years, people have switched to S corporations, and depending upon when they have switched to S corporations, if they sell any of their assets within 10 years, they still have to pay some corporate income taxes. With the tax law that came in, into effect in 2010, effective for 2011, they do not have to pay tax on these built-in gains, which is the term they use for these profits that were in the corporation when they switched to S corporation, if they've held the assets for more than 5 years. So I think those are some of the benefits to the closely held businesses.
So have you, how do I say this? And this is a business show, not a political show, so we don't have any political affiliation nor focus on that. But
it's a hard area not to address, but we'll try and stay away from there.
Okay, but have you seen other measures that have been enacted at a federal level that have attempted to provide incentives for closely held mid-market companies or mid-market companies to make investments, whether it be accelerated depreciation or any other elements that you would like to share with our audience at this point, Gary?
Sure. One of the provisions of expensing of equipment that you acquire is to allow you to write that off up to a certain amount. So if you bought a new piece of equipment, you could expense it rather than depreciate it. For 2011, the limitation will be $500,000 as long as you don't spend over $2 million. So if you spend over $2 million, the excess dollar for dollar will reduce the amount that you can expense. But a $500,000 incentive for write-off is very, very good. There's also bonus depreciation where they've increased the limitation from 50% to 100%. They've increased the allowance for depreciation on certain restaurants and leaseholds. So rather than being 39%, it's 39 years, it's 15 years. So those are helping the smaller businesses and giving them the incentive to spend money.
Right, and so in a slow economy as we've been through in many sectors, if not across the board, there is a way that the government can attempt to create a behavior and incentive, and these are pretty powerful. The two that you just highlighted could, for many firms, be a very significant advantage if they have the ability, right, to make the investment in the equipment. They can get a financial benefit very short term versus waiting longer term for that benefit to accrue to the business. So those are important areas that I'm glad you highlighted for our audience.
It provides quite a bit of incentive, and there's also the ability to be able to utilize that, and two, the ability to finance the acquisitions depending upon the business. But if somebody is in manufacturing or buys equipment, this is a great opportunity for them to substantially reduce their taxes.
And it's encouraged that they do that based on the way the changes were made. So it's totally expected that if you have the ability to do it, you would do it. So everybody, I mean, it's a positive potential gain for everyone involved, including moving some capital equipment and creating some demand in the marketplace when demand has been slack given the slower recession that we've been facing into. Okay.
It's a win-win situation.
I believe it is, and that's why I was excited to have you on, Gary, because part of what we try to do with Critical Mass, the radio show, well, all of what we try to do is help our listeners make better business decisions. And in this area, I think it's good to have an expert, as you clearly are, share with our audience what you see as an opportunity for them to be able to take advantage of. So I just have a couple quick questions, and then we'll let you go for the interview. But could you share with us kind of an experience or a lesson that you learned in your practice that kind of came through a painful or difficult time, but yet the valuable lesson that you learned was one that you carry with you today?
As I mentioned earlier, listening is a very, very important part of what we do in helping our clients out. We had the opportunity to work with one of our original clients in the sale of his business. He had an incredible offer, everything that he wanted. And in doing due diligence for him with the buyer, there was some information that didn't come out as clean as we had expected. So we said to the buyer, we'd like to switch to cash, and we'll give you a discount. And the buyer's eyes lit up and went to take advantage of it, made certain promises. The buyer never was able to fulfill his promises. He went bankrupt maybe 2 or 3 months after the chance to buy our client's business. And fortunately, just by being proactive and listening, we were able to save our client's business. And he was able to go on and continue working it until he had the opportunity to retire. So I think, again, watching and listening is very, very important.
What would have been the outcome if you hadn't been in that position of watching and listening? What could have been the alternative?
In this particular situation, my client would have been wiped out. He would have been his 25 years or 30 years of hard work would have been lost because his note would not have had any value, and because of the bankruptcy, he would have never collected anything. So his total net worth would have been wiped out. And being in his, at that time, I think he was in his early 50s, he would have not had anything left and had to just rechange his whole life. So fortunately, he avoided that problem.
Well, those are two very different extreme ends of the outcome, and certainly it's clear which one is in everyone's best interest, right, to have the outcome that you were able to deliver for your client. Gary, if someone on the either listening live or some future point on a podcast, iTunes or whatever, would like to learn more about your practice, how do they find you on the web?
Okay, we have our website, which is www.kramerolsen.com, and it's O-L-S-E-N for the Olsen. And we're also available by phone, 714-558-3236.
Well, I appreciate the time that you've spent with us here on the show. I really appreciate your perspective and giving of your expertise to the audience. And, you know, thanks for being a friend of Critical Mass Radio Show, and welcome to our business community.
Thank you so much, and I greatly appreciate the opportunity today.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Bye. Doug and I believe that business owners and executives learn best from the experiences of peers. I believe you agree that in listening to Gary talk, many of us can learn simply from being exposed to him, what he knows about the changing tax laws, very valuable. And for him to be willing to come on the Critical Mass Radio Show and share that was also something that was – this is what happens every month in our CEO peer groups. The opportunity to be in the same room with 11 other executives, many of whom are business owners – can have a significant positive impact on the quality of the decisions that you would make as a member. You know, just because you're in business for yourself, that does not mean you have to be in business by yourself. And if you're interested in learning more about our CEO peer groups, then I would encourage you to check out our website, www.criticalmassforbusiness.com. We're going to be back with our second guest, Dan Merkel of Lexipol LLC. But before we do that, we're going to step away for this message from Smart Business Magazine.
Smart Business Network is a business-to-business multimedia company providing insight, advice, and strategy for C-level executives of fast growth, middle market, and large companies. As one of the nation's largest publishers of local management journals, under the Smart Business name, Smart Business Network publishes 19 regional print editions, presents dozens of large and small-scale business conferences and award programs, and produces a vibrant interactive digital media presence. For more information, visit us at www.sbnonline.com.
Hi, this is Rick Franzi, and welcome back to this edition of Critical Mass, the radio show. If you'd like to join in on the conversation during the show, the best way to attempt to do that is logging on or being on octalkradio.net's website, log on to their community chat room, post your thoughts. My producer, Paul, is checking it periodically and will let me know, if, and possibly will bring your thoughts onto the show. As I said, Dan Merkel, CEO of Lexipol, is my second guest. And then Lexipol is America's leading source for risk management resources, and they're delivering services through a unique web-based development system that has integrated training. So I'm excited to have Dan on Critical Mass, the radio show, and welcome to the program this afternoon.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Why don't we get started, Dan? Would you share with our audience your kind of professional background and your path to your current position?
I'm a serial entrepreneur. This is my fifth company, and they've been in a variety of industries and locations, but I found two things that were common to all of them and seems to match up with my skill set. One is that the industry is going through a high degree of change. To me, that always represents opportunity. You can displace powerful, entrenched players, and solutions are more typically adopted more quickly. The second factor is I really like to build enterprises through collaborative efforts. I'm not one that would subscribe to the Pepsi versus Coke business model where to get something you've got to take it from someone else. I really like identifying other entities, other individuals that have a vested interest in the same solutions, and that seems to make life a lot more enjoyable.
Okay, so tell us a bit about Lexipol then, and how does that fit with your background and your interests?
Lexipol is a provider of risk management services to primarily the public safety sector. Our current clientele includes over 1,000 police departments, sheriff's departments, and law enforcement agencies of all types in 15 states. What we provide for them really is a set of tools to allow them to address their people, policy, training, supervision, and discipline. And probably the difference in our approach is that our team is made up of folks who have significant and deep experience in the field. So we've got command staff officers of all level and in the field troops. And we've also got a pretty crack legal team. And oftentimes they're the same. Officers and command staff who have gone back and gotten their law degrees. In this particular arena, both of those risks are highly important to the officer in the field, both being safe as well as being able to defend their actions in court. So we tend to bleed over both of those areas and assist them in determining what's appropriate conduct and policy for dealing with a dangerous world out there.
You know, I am fascinated by your market address, and I've enjoyed getting to understand your business better through the process of meeting you and preparing for your interview here on the radio show. And we're going to talk a little bit later about, you know, kind of additional uniqueness in your marketing strategy and your positioning. I find it, as you talk, also very easy to understand how important training is to the agencies that you support, because much of their actions can be questioned after the fact, and how important documented training must be to that process.
Yeah, it's an unforgiving society oftentimes in what the law enforcement agencies do. If they're not there in time or not taking care of the perceived threat that's going on, they're always criticized as being inefficient or delinquent or late or that sort of thing. But unfortunately, most of the times when they show up and they are dealing with a stress situation, they're criticized later for not understanding that, oh, this is just a good kid and he would never have done anything wrong. So they're classically in that damned if you do, damned if you don't. And really where they have to understand, the law enforcement officers, is what is the guidance that really determines a day later, a month later, a year later, the appropriateness and reasonableness of their actions. And we as a public don't deal with those stressful situations that much, hopefully. But the officers oftentimes in that daily. And quite frankly, I don't know of any other job on our soil in America that getting shot at is part of your job description. But unfortunately, that's what cops go through.
You know, that's the element, too, that I neglected to mention that you brought out so well, is that not only do they have to be trained well, but they have to retain it under pressure. And for any of us that understand stress or have been under stress, I can't imagine it stress, as you just said, you know, being shot at. But at the end of the day, later you have to recount how you made decisions, and training has really got to be so ingrained in them that they can recall it under times when they're not thinking it, maybe not as clearly, but they have external, you know, stimulation that's very dangerous, and they have to be, you know, thinking very quickly. So it's a critical area that you serve, and it was one that I'm fascinated by, and I appreciate the fact that you're giving your time to be on the radio show today.
My pleasure.
I'd like to ask you if you could share with us, of all the experience and lessons that you've learned in your career, what is your guiding principle for how you're building Lexipol today and moving forward in your business?
Well, as I mentioned, there's really two commonalities of all the businesses I've built. And basically, I kind of like a rapidly changing environment, an industry in rapid degrees of change. And the other is about the collaboration. I was extremely fortunate to spend a bit of time with Peter Drucker right before we formed this company. And at that point in Peter's life, he was really talking about management challenges for the next century. And he talked a great deal about the migration of commerce in America to be really performed by knowledge workers. And the elements of managing and creating effective groups that are really involved in knowledge management, that's central to our company. And really what he talked about was the migration of networked management structures as opposed to hierarchy that we typically see in factories and management challenges of past decades. And the element that he really emphasized was that for knowledge workers to be productive, efficient, accurate, all the things that you're looking for, they have to feel empowered. They have to feel that their work is meaningful, and that they can make decisions with their brains. If you can structure something that incorporates that as a core culture of the company, it's really unbounded of what can be accomplished. And I see that every day in our little company. I see that in lots of companies around the world that are going through high degrees of change and adapting to what we see as a pretty interesting society that we all live in. So empowering the knowledge worker, making clear they understand what their contribution is how it's affecting either the company or their clients, really is a guiding principle for everything that we do here.
You know, empowering the knowledge worker is not complicated, but the challenge is greater, I guess, by the fact that the rate of change within what the knowledge worker needs to know is moving very quickly, and the age demographic of a knowledge worker is also changing, and their learning behavior and styles are different. So to be focused on that, it's an area that's probably fits with your interest as well, because there is constant change, and it is evolving very rapidly and quickly.
It is, and I think it's one of the things that we've been able to recruit high-achieving, self-accountable individuals who really like the work first. They're excited about what new challenges will be coming through, and quite frankly, I'll tell you, in the world of law enforcement, it's never a dull day. But being able to see those challenges, process them, and coming up with directions and solutions that are well researched and well reasoned. It really helps get through your day and feel like you've made an accomplishment by the time you get to the end of your day.
Thank you for that answer to the question and follow-up. I'd like to move the conversation over to peer groups and you use the term collaboration, collaborative, and obviously I, being an author of a book on how business leaders can benefit from being in a collaborative mindset with other peer business leaders, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about maybe some direct experience that you've had where you've benefited collaboration and outside influences.
Absolutely. One of the companies that I built was back in the mid to late 80s was building housing developments, American-style housing developments in Japan. I had virtually no experience in the overseas market, and what I was fortunate to become acquainted with were a number of U.S. executives who had built Japanese Business Roundtable. And they really were very helpful in helping each other understand the differences of about a different market, a different industry. And it was my first experience at really understanding the power of collaborative, mutually beneficial conversations that were highly authentic, highly transparent. And it was fun. It was like going back to school. And the finding the right gentleman, the right group, the right facilitators, all of those elements I think are just invaluable when you're looking at learning things that we don't know yet, but you can certainly learn from others who have been there.
Yeah, many times it's what you don't know you don't know that they're out there and it's real. It can have a dramatic, and if you're in the room with other people who maybe know some of that, just the fact that they can make you aware of it can really help you avoid if it's a negative or capitalize on an opportunity as well.
Absolutely.
All right, let's talk about your firm. Kind of, we all have business challenges. It comes with the territory of being the CEO. Could you explain a current challenge facing your firm and the ideas that you're considering or maybe begun to implement in an attempt to mitigate that challenge or those challenges?
Well, you know, there isn't anybody out there, I don't think, that's not affected by the economic restructuring going on throughout the world. And we're doing extremely well. Our clients are a bit strained right now, and our clients of over 1,000 local and state governments are really dealing with a paradigm shift that I believe none of them have had to address before. And the challenges of accepting that revenues, if you're a state and local government, either through sales tax, income tax, property taxes, whatever, are not likely to be at the level that they've experienced historically is extremely challenging. And I believe what we've heard oftentimes in the early parts of these types of cycles is, you know, team, we just have to do more with less. Well, we're basically rejecting that axiom. It's clearly gone past that. We have to figure out how to do less with less. And addressing those priorities, understanding what local governments need to do, is really a painful and difficult process for them to oftentimes go through. What we're doing is helping them understand the dynamics of the economy, what the likely trends are that they're going to be seeing, and really processes for engaging in their communities to answer those questions of how do we provide what we should provide and how can we partner perhaps with others to deal with the issues that we can no longer afford. So I think the economic constraints are an opportunity, if you will. We've not had this kind of pressure within governmental entities, at least in my lifetime that I can recall. And it is an opportunity to really look at what should we and what do we really need to provide and what are areas that we've perhaps strayed into that can be dealt with in other manners.
Those are hard questions for a private organization, company or firm, or a public corporation to ask of itself. But to have a government institution, there's another layer that goes, I think, on top of the challenge for them to figure out, okay, what is our core mission and what are our absolute necessities that we have to deliver? And I think you're right, Dan. We are in doing this show for a couple of years now, I've heard from so many different business leaders that we're at a point in time unlike any other that they have seen in their professional business career. And many of them have been in, you know, in the working world for decades. I'm observing that we are on many fronts in somewhat uncharted territory here in the United States relative to the conditions that we have to make decisions against. There's not really examples that we can look to in the past that would be guideposts. We're sort of rewriting the script a bit given the situation that we're in this country right now.
Absolutely. And I think the governmental entities are probably the least skilled at this because they've not had historically the competitive pressures or the metrics of measurement that oftentimes the business community has. We've developed some good skill sets in this being on the private side. And we need to share what we've learned and some of the processes that we've learned to apply them within the governmental sector. I think they're eager to hear that. I think it's a little bit intimidating from time to time. But if it can be done in a very constructive and supportive manner, I think we have great opportunity.
And what you just said is my silver lining potential, which is sometimes as the adversity increases, the willingness to collaborate and to work together and find new solutions also goes up because you can't retreat back to what you've been doing before because it's become self-evident that that's not a successful strategy. So my hope is from all of these different areas of new and different challenges comes new and different thinking, right, that allows us to solve problems in a way that we haven't maybe that's got – I think it was Einstein, you can't solve a problem using the same thinking that got you into the situation. So maybe that's what is being required of us, not just in the public sector but the private sector as well.
He's one of those guys that seems to have figured a few things out.
Yes. Okay. I'd like to ask you another question, which is I'm intrigued by companies that have – been able to successfully navigate the past few years of economic challenges, and clearly your firm is one of those. And you and I talked briefly about these four strategies that I've seen successful mid-market entrepreneurial companies exhibit, whether they are, you know, relevant to their market or being authentic because they have unique skills that come from within the company or they're agile in how they make decisions in their thoughts and the way they structure their organizations, or they're a creative and open organization that, you know, is solving problems that their clients aren't even, you know, aware that they have yet, and so they're kind of developing solutions to unmet needs. And I'm wondering if you could spend a minute with our audience kind of reflecting on those four strategies and just sort of mapping to the degree that you can what you've been doing in your firm relative to how other companies are of similar size are able to kind of grow and prosper in tougher economic times.
Well, it was great for you to share these areas that you've looked at and identified as competitive advantages in the marketplace. It is interesting to us because it basically is a documentation of our manifesto. These are clearly the things that we believe in at our core level here. And I think of all these things that it would come back to what's the most meaningful attribute of these things or summary of these things together might really be around the need for credibility and trust. I think that could be an overlying characteristic in many of these areas. And the reason I think that is so critical now is the statements you made previous to this, and that is we're in a new time. We're in a time of restructuring. And many of our places of security and trust have been questioned. Many of us thought that we'd always be able to buy a General Motors product and feel solid about them, but I laughed at one point that my partner said, you know, Lexapol will someday be bigger than General Motors. Well, we all laughed and thought that was funny. Well, at one point we were, because General Motors was at zero. So the assumptions we've had about what we rely upon and what we trust and what we take for granted as assumptions, I think are largely questioned. And so what we've tried to do here is really let every person of our team know And the people that we deal with in other states know that personal credibility and personal trust has to be present throughout the entire organization. The elements that you talk about here as far as strategies are typically identified as the enterprise, and I completely believe you're absolutely accurate in how you portray these. I think it goes one layer deeper, and that is that each individual in the enterprise has to be able to be thinking in those ways and portray themselves to their other partners, whether they be internal employees, other customers, vendors, whatever they happen to be. And I think that's the piece that we've taken to the next level, is really creating self-accountability and credibility and trust at all levels of the company, so that management doesn't have to just represent that, but virtually everybody within the organization.
Because if management represents it and the organization can't, it doesn't really exist in the client's mind. It might exist in your mind as the management team, but the client experience with your company is their experience with your people.
And I completely agree. I won't name the cell phone company, but there's one that I've used for years that, you know, is a motto about, you know, let me make sure I've 100% satisfied you or something like that. The reality is it does not exist at the employee level. It just is so far from the truth. It's their corporate motto. I'm sure management's trying to do that, but it's not authentic. It doesn't happen all the way through. And so we as customers in every sector completely see that. The world is so transparent now that you really have to have these things you're talking about, not just at the enterprise level, but right down to every single individual.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. I'm actually in the process of developing a book around these points, and I may at some point, I'd like to be able to come back to you off the radio show, Dan, and talk with you about possibly featuring your company in a little bit more detail as an example of one of the companies that are using these strategies. So we'll talk. We're open to it.
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to talk about an opportunity for growth, you know, facing your business. It's a growing concern. You're focused really well in a niche. I understand the niche is under some stress because of the, you know, taxes, et cetera, the revenues that are coming to them and their budgets. But share with us how you see, you know, an opportunity and the impact that it could have on your business if you're able to successfully leverage that growth opportunity.
We are branching into other areas of public safety. Certainly, we've been in development of content and services for the fire industry for the last couple years. That will be coming out this year. So taking much of what we've learned with the law enforcement side of the house and applying it over on the other major piece of public safety, which is the fire industry. Now, they've got some needs for assistance in their industries, for sure. We're really looking at how we can help entities of all sizes identify the true cost of risk management failure. Risk management so often been defined as an economic issue. It's what is my cost for insurance, or how do I hedge a particular risk through an economic strategy? We believe that that's important, certainly, but perhaps even more important is the trust, the candor, and the customer perceptions of what happens to you when you fail. And so the issues around the scrutiny from the society, we think, is perhaps even more costly to enterprises than just simply the more easily defined economics. So we're really taking what we've learned in the public safety sector and applying it to a number of risk-centric operations. And that's quite interesting because we think that has opportunity for folks to guard themselves against whatever threats that they are likely to see. And those are becoming more diverse and more ill-defined each day, in our opinion.
Can you give me a brief example of how that might manifest itself? Can you characterize an application for that?
Well, there's some interesting statistics in the aviation industry. I'll just pick that as one. When you see plane crashes in a variety of different circumstances, and then take a look at the safety record of Southwest Airlines. Southwest Airlines has an impeccable safety record, and they fly all the same aircraft. They have hugely strong employee empowerment programs. There's a number of things they do that they really take into account. As an example, you'll see Southwest, when they land, they take the entire strip. Many airlines are really on the brakes quickly, trying to get off over to the gate. Southwest has figured out that, in fact, not heating up the brakes on a quick stop is one of their risk management processes. Take a look at the statistics of what happens when there's an airline failure. Most people suffer, except Southwest. And so we as a consumer understand the impacts that are wider in trust and confidence and those sorts of things than just the economic strategy of buying insurance and hiring attorneys after something goes wrong. So there's just an almost unlimited number of applications for practically, operationally, structurally applying risk management other than the historical economic models.
Well, that's a great example and a great company to choose. And as you're answering that, I'm thinking as well, as the world becomes more, as business becomes more complex, risk accelerates, and you need to be able to assess the risk in the decisions that you're making and moving forward in a more, see how your tools and your processes and systems could align themselves in other markets. So thanks for explaining that, Dan. I appreciate it.
You bet.
All right. Well, Dan Merkel of Lexipol LLC, I appreciate your time and thoughtful answers to my questions. Thanks for being a friend of Critical Mass, the radio show. If someone would like to learn more about your firm, how do they do that online, Dan?
Website is www.lexipol, that's LEXIPOL.com. And if you go down the right-hand corner, there's a little tip of the day that comes out from my partner, Gordon Graham, and he talks about a fairly practical tip that might even help you out. So that's how you find us.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today, and welcome to the Critical Mass for Business community.
Thank you, Rick. It was a pleasure.
Bye. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our show today, and the two interviews that I conducted might have provided you with ideas and information to help you make. I would like to thank Smart Business Magazine for sponsoring the show today. Smart Business Magazine is a management journal providing insight and advice for top decision makers. To learn more about Smart Business Magazine and our network of magazines, visit www.sbnonline.com. If you'd like to learn more about Critical Mass for Business, check out our website, www.criticalmassforbusiness.com. You know, this is Rick Franzi, host of Critical Mass, the radio show, saying until we talk again, I hope all your decisions move your company in a positive direction.
You've been listening to Critical Mass, only on OCTalkRadio.net.